All right. So, if you don't mind, we can start now. I'd like to introduce you to the audience. We're here with Dr. Jack Rasmus, who is a professor at St. Mary's College in California. You're a political economist, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Right.
Where did you study political economy? It's not common in the United States to find political economy degrees.
No, it's not. I was given a full fellowship to study at University of Toronto in Canada. So
Wonderful.
that's where I learned my political economy, I guess you would call it. And I did some research at LSE as well, but
Great.
that's my background. Plus 15 years in the labor union movement when I graduated. And then I went into the tech industry for 20 years as a strategic analyst. That's where I got my business background. And I've been teaching for about 15 years after that.
You know, I've been reading you for a long time on ZMag, and I found an article that you wrote at the end of September. We were coming up on the well, we had our the 10th year anniversary since the September 15th Lehman Brothers collapse. Your article was called "The Next Crisis," and I wanted to get in touch because I'd like to talk to you about the last crisis we had in 08, and then also what the next crisis might look like. So perhaps you could start by talking about the parallels and comparisons of 1929 and 2008.
Okay. Well, the main parallel is that each of the crises were preceded by a financial crash and a financial crisis. In the case of 1929, the roots, the seeds of the crisis, the Great Depression, occurred in the decade previously. You see, most mainstream economists just talk about identify the timelines of depressions and great recessions and whatever from the point in which the collapse starts. But that's only half of the cycle. You really have to study the preceding period to get the full cycle, because it's in the preceding period that financial asset prices turn into bubbles. And then the question becomes, well, why do they turn into bubbles? Why do you have these bubbles? And then when the bubbles start breaking, financial asset prices collapse. That causes defaults and losses for the banks. And then the banks' balance sheets start to collapse. In other words, they turn red. And when the banks in turn begin to experience troubles, they freeze up their lending, which propagates the problem, the contagion, to the non-bank, non-financial sector of the economy. And if businesses can't get loans to continue, non-bank, non-financial businesses, then they have to engage in mass layoffs and cutting costs, and some of them default if they've had too much debt. Mass layoffs start, and now you've got a problem with consumption. And when you have consumption layoff and consumption, people aren't buying the goods, which exacerbates the problem for the non-financial companies. And they lay off more. Now you're in a vicious cycle, downward cycle. And as non-financial companies start to default, the banks are in even greater trouble in terms of their losses, and they freeze up even more, et cetera, et cetera. And you're in this downward spiral. So the origins of it really are in the pre-crisis period. And you need to understand that. And that's what a lot of my studies are, focusing on the financial bubbles and the financial side and why you have financial bubbles. Well, you have financial bubbles because of excess credit. Well, why is there excess credit? And that's because the central bank pursues a policy of too much easy money for too long. So that's how you trace it all back. My book, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy in the Coming Depression, published last year, looks at the Federal Reserve from its origins in the pre-1913 period all the way through its current period under Janet Yellen. And also looks at the in parallel the practices of other major central banks and how they've done the same thing. The European Central Bank, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, and even the People's Bank of China. Ever since the 1970s and the collapse of the Bretton Woods International Monetary Agreement, which turned central banks loose, and those central banks began pumping excess liquidity for every reason into the global economy, led by the United States, by the way, we've had this what they call liquidity put, a financial term, which means just you keep central banks keep pumping all the free money for, every time there's a crisis and when there's not a crisis. In the case of the U.S. leading this charge in the 1980s, it was all about the U.S. Coming up with a new mix of policies called neoliberalism, which were responsible for the globalization and the financialization of the global economy. And that built up over years, over decades since the Reagan period, and began precipitating financial bubbles in the 90s and so forth until we get the housing bubble and the collapse in 2008. Actually, the collapse of 2008 was a derivatives bubble. People think of it as a housing bubble, but it was mortgage-backed securities, MBSs and CMBSs on the commercial side, which are derivatives. Derivatives simply meaning a financial security created from another financial security. And that's what really spread and propagated the credit crash that began. It starts in the housing sector because that's where you get the derivatives, MBSs, and so forth. And derivatives on top of derivatives were created. You took MBSs, mortgage bond-backed securities, mortgage bonds, you put them together. You get a mortgage-backed security. You mark it up and you sell that, not just the mortgage. You see, mm-hmm. it starts with the home, a real asset, but then you get a mortgage on top of the real asset, and then you combine the mortgages, and then you chop up the mortgage bonds, and you add to it collateralized debt obligations, asset-backed security, all these other derivatives, and you're building a house of cards, of derivatives, on top of the little old house. And you keep doing that, derivatives on top of derivatives, because every time you create a derivative, you mark it up and sell it. And then you have credit default swaps insuring against the collapse. So it was a house of derivatives cards that were really behind the 2008 crash that then spread to the banks, and you had a general freeze-up going on. Shadow banks as well as commercial banks. In 1929, to get back to the, you know, specific comparison, you, of course, had the stock market bubble and the bust of the stock market. You had a recession that was already beginning before the October crash, but it was just a normal recession, pretty much, in early 29, manufacturing and the autos and so forth. But when you got the crash of 1929, it led to financial asset prices falling. And then what happened in 1930s was the stock market crash just precipitated the whole process. What happened was a series of four banking crashes that followed in the United States. 1930, 31, 32, 33, every year for 4 years in a row, a banking crisis and crash. The last one was the worst. And when that happened, you had a ratcheting down of the real economy. Every time you had a banking crash, it spilled over to the real economy and caused more stress and more defaults. And that went on for four or five years, you see. And it didn't stop until FDR came into office in 33, mid-33, roughly March. And bailed out the banks. But you can bail out the banks and stop the further crash, but a monetary solution, and this is very important, a monetary solution may stop the crash, but it does not necessarily generate a recovery of the real economy, you see? And that's very important for the 2008 event and the poor recovery that followed. We can come back to that. But in 33, what Roosevelt does, bails out the banks, right, and institutes a pro-business recovery program called the National Recovery Act, the NRA. Mm-hmm. And that was all about helping businesses raise their prices, because when you have the crash, prices collapse. You have severe deflation, first in financial assets and then in real goods and services. And that was a big problem. So he institutes the NRA. The NRA does not really, in 33-34, stimulate a recovery. Things kind of move sideways. There's a little bit of recovery for 6 months, and then it flattens out. And in the summer of 34, businesses were pushing him to go even deeper in a pro-business recovery policies. He changed his mind. His advisors, Mariner Eccles and the others, Francis Perkins and so forth, convinced him to introduce the New Deal programs. You see, the New Deal was not the first thing he did. But he did this in 1934. He started promising, if after the November 34 midterm elections, if you elect me, we're going to have Social Security, we're going to have Works Progress Administration, we're going to have Homeowners Loan Corporation, we're going to bail out of homeowners, we're going to give people jobs, the government will, we're going to put money in people's pockets, etc. In other words, stimulate the economy from the bottom up. Mm-hmm. Go after Main Street and put money in the hands of Main Street so that they could start buying things, and then that would stimulate business to invest and recover. A monetary solution means we're going to give free money to the bankers and the finance people in the hopes that they'll trickle down a little bit of it to generate investment. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is that the trickle-down's too small. But the other problem with that is banks can try to start lending, but if people are so bad off, they're not going to borrow.
Right.
That's the problem with a monetary solution. Well, he abandoned that in 1934. The Democrats swept Congress in the midterm elections even more than they had in 1932, and then we had the New Deal in 35-36. Mm-hmm. Now, contrast that with Obama. Obama in 2008 comes in, right, and he bails out the banks. Actually, the Federal Reserve bailed out the banks to the tune of $6 trillion, to my estimate. He institutes a minuscule fiscal spending program. I say minuscule because if you look at the Obama's 2009 recovery program, $300 billion of it was tax cuts, mostly for businesses. Mm-hmm. Another $300 billion he gave to his folks in the states, and hopefully the states were supposed to spend it. Well, the states sat on the money. And then another $100 billion or so in long-term infrastructure investing that would not have an immediate effect.
Can I stop you there just for a sec? I got a couple questions. One is, and this all happened before the midterms of 2010. So he had a Democratic Congress.
Yes.
And he could have, you know, my question, so a third of the stimulus is in tax cuts. And we know that the multiplier effect of tax cuts doesn't go very far, or at least not as far as, you know, extending unemployment insurance or food stamps. Why is it that he and the Democrats don't do more?
Well, that's a very good question, man. And if you look at what happened, initially the Democrats in Congress wanted to give $150 billion more in tax cuts to households. Mm-hmm. But Larry Summers, who was his Obama's advisors, convinced him that the economy couldn't take more tax cuts, which is BS, right? And so Obama pulled. Congress actually, the Democrats in the House actually wanted to spend more on tax cuts for households, but Obama minimized it. Guys like Krugman were calling for $1 trillion. I was saying at the time you need at least $1.5 trillion in direct household fiscal spending get the recovery going. Right.
Well, so this goes back to the question: what was going on? Why was he listening to people like Summers, and why were so much of the tax cuts directed towards corporations rather than households? What's happening here internally within the administration?
Well, it was his advisors who were very pro-business, pro-bankers, you see. Mm-hmm. In my 2012 book, Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few, I traced very carefully the election year and his program and the evolution of his program and proposals during that election year, and then the people he appointed when he got into office. Very clearly, the consensus was that we need to have a monetary driven recovery stimulus, a monetary driven recovery. And that's exactly what they did. That's why they pumped so much money into the banks. And the idea was, once again, if you give the banks $5 trillion, you know, they weren't talking about that number, you know, maybe a fifth of that will get into the real economy stimulating jobs. So it was a top down stimulus, monetary stimulus, compared to Roosevelt's bottom up fiscal household spending stimulus. That's the big difference.
Was this because Obama was afraid of scaring the bond market?
Well, no, I think Obama was very much an opportunist and pretty much did whatever his advisors wanted him to do. You know, he came into the election at the very last minute, pushed by Chicago money and the Pritzker family. You know, he was plucked out of no man's land in the state assembly just a couple of years previous to that, you know, and then pushed into the Senate. I think he pretty much was willing to go along with whatever his advisors told him to. And that was a big problem. You know, you contrast the 2010 midterms with the 1934 midterms. Mm-hmm. In 2010, we get by the summer of 2010, the Obama recovery with that weak recovery fiscal program was faltering, just as the NRA under FDR was faltering after a year. But FDR turned to the New Deal, whereas what Obama did was double down, as business asked him to, on a monetary tax cut driven, business tax cut driven recovery. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what he did. He passed another $800 billion in tax cuts at the end of 2010, all for business, right? He extended the Bush tax cuts that should have expired at the end of 2010 for another 2 years. That cost $450 billion a year. In other words, he doubled down on massive business tax cuts and continuing massive Federal Reserve Central Bank monetary stimulus. Mm-hmm. But tax cuts have the same effect, or lack of same effect, that low interest rates have when you're in a deep crisis. In other words, you can cut taxes all you want. If people aren't buying the goods and services from business, business will pocket the tax cuts and do nothing until they see the stimulus, the demand. And you can lower interest rates and lower interest rate costs, but that won't necessarily stimulate bank lending, which it did not.
And then you get the Tea Party in that midterms. I mean, the rise of the Tea Party is sort of, people aren't seeing that the stimulus is going anywhere. It's not leading to a recovery in the real economy. And it feels like we just wasted a ton of money. And then you have, you know, the rise of fiscal austerity and the Tea Party people.
That's right. You know, you have to understand that even his weak 2009 fiscal stimulus program and the composition of it, which was all wrong, as I mentioned, right? In August of 2011, they retract $1 trillion in stimulus.
Oh, wow.
And this time the cuts are in education and other social programs. You know, so they took it all back.
It's a very short period of stimulus, you're saying.
Well, not only a short period, the composition, mostly tax cuts and money that went to the states that wasn't spent, right? And then followed with a real fiscal austerity. which reduced consumption even more just a year later. You know, so that's austerity American style, mm-hmm. as I called it at the time. Mm-hmm. And we get this very, very weak recovery, and he gets swamped. The Democrats get wiped out, as you know, in the midterms in 2010, which is a big contrast to what happened with FDR in 34. The Democrats really, you know, clean slate, wiped out the Republicans because of the promise. There was a promise to Main Street, we're going to do a Main Street stimulus called the New Deal. That's why the Democrats got wiped out in 2010. And the story ever since 2010 is Democrat defeats and failures, mm-hmm. In terms of policy. Obama keeps extending his hand to the Republicans, and the Republicans are convinced they're going to shoot this guy down and give him nothing, including Supreme Court nominees, but also the economy. You know, McConnell just shut him out everywhere, and he just kept extending his hand, and the Republicans kept biting it, mm-hmm. and he just went on and on doing that and sat on his butt in Washington. You know, contrast that with Trump, who's out there in giving speeches every day almost, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was a disaster. Response.
Let me stop you there for a sec, because there are clearly Obama's a very bright guy. And the history is, you know, he just has to go to the history books to see what Roosevelt did to turn the 1934 elections. And you had people like Krugman and people like yourself saying, hey, this is bad policy. Why isn't he listening? Why isn't he going back and looking at the history?
Because the bankers are telling him, bail us out first. And the bankers are running the show behind the scenes, I believe. And that's why they want a banker-driven first, bail us out first kind of a monetary policy. Contrast that with FDR, who had people like Mariner Eccles and Francis Perkins and all these others who had a kind of true liberal, even, you know, democratic socialist background. Mm-hmm. And you got to stimulate the real economy. So it was the advisors. Mm-hmm. And it's a reflection of the fact that ever since we have neoliberalism, the banking folks and the shadow banking folks, shadow banking meaning investment banks, hedge funds, private equity, finance companies, and so forth, that are bigger now than the J.P. Morgans and so forth in terms of total assets. Mm-hmm. These people, well, I mean, look who's running the Trump economic policy. It's Goldman Sachs.
Right.
You know, all the key people are Goldman Sachs, right? Under Obama, it was Goldman Sachs, and before that, it was Citigroup. And Robert Rubin and all those guys under Clinton and George W. Bush. And, of course, Citigroup almost collapsed. They were effectively bankrupt in 2008. So they lost their political influence. But Goldman Sachs stepped into that political vacuum, and the bankers are still running the show. Mnuchin is a Goldman Sachser, right?
But is your argument essentially that this is what led to the weak fiscal stimulus is what and the bad – mix of stimulus and tax cuts, the composition of the stimulus, that this is what led to the Trump victory in 2016?
Played a very big role because of the lack of real recovery in any sense, measured in any sense. At the same time, the ravages of free trade on those Midwest swing states. And the growing income, obvious income inequality, the lack of any wage, actually real wages continued to decline 1-2% under Obama virtually every year. So that led to, the real discontent in that manufacturing heartland. And I was writing in the summer of 2016 saying, watch out, Trump is turning the blue-collar workers, and he's going to win the swing states. You can go and read my articles. I was saying that. Mm-hmm.
You were. And this September, you were also warning that let's not count our chickens before they hatch with regards to this quote-unquote blue wave in November of 2018. This November, you're not sure that the Democrats are going to retake the House.
No, or if they do, it will be very narrow. I'm skeptical of that because, you know, what's the evidence? What's the evidence? And the evidence is the same pollsters who in November of 2016 were saying Trump was only going to get 15% of the vote, you know?
But
same pollsters are now talking blue wave, and the Democrats are whipping up blue wave. There is some evidence of increased interest, but there's also evidence of mobilization on the right, you see, and this Kavanaugh deal is really going to mobilize them as well. And I think, you know, it all depends on the turnout, but I'm not so sure that it's going to be a massive blue wave. And I'm writing something right now that if it's not a massive blue wave, just think about the shock to political consciousness in the country if Trump pulls off a victory here in November. Just think of the shock it will have on liberals, as great as 2016 was, right?
Right. I mean, I think they'll be totally demoralized. And further, I think, you know, if you look at a place like Turkey and what's happened there in the last decade, the liberal class has essentially shrunken back into themselves. They've totally stopped. They've disengaged from politics altogether, and they've kind of abdicated this space to Erdogan. So I could imagine, and same thing's happening in Hungary now, and probably to a certain extent in Italy, and definitely in Russia. So I could imagine that happening here if the left, if the liberals lose in November, I can imagine a total retreat.
Yeah, well, you missed the hottest, latest example of that trend, which is Brazil.
Yeah.
Bolsonaro looks like he's going to win. Mm-hmm. And if he does, I mean, how can you imagine with the conditions in Brazil that a guy like Bolsonaro would win? Well, the ultra-right always appeals to the working class, you see. Mm-hmm. I've gone back and I'm starting to read some of the origins of Hitler and Nazism in the early 20s, you know, the formation of the party and so forth. And there are some eerie comparisons here with the Trump phenomenon and all this right wing phenomenon.
Yeah. And you brought up the fact that even if the Democrats win in November and they start to threaten impeachment, that there'll actually be the rise of the far right, but not in electoral terms, but actually on the street and in kind of paramilitary terms, right?
Yes, I think that Bannon and Breitbart and those guys are just waiting for the opportunity to step in and organize with a lot of billionaire right-wing money, organize street demonstrations and protests. They're waiting for this opportunity, right? Up to now, the street demonstrations and protests have been kind of spontaneous and eclectic, not really organized, directed, and run from the top. But I foresee the possibility, very real, that if the Democrats win, let's say, in the House and they initiate proceedings, impeachment proceedings, I don't think they'll ever impeach him. I think they just want to run it for the 2020 elections, you see. If that happens, I think Bannon and the right is going to get organized, and you're going to see a lot of counter demonstrations. And you may see them anyway, because now, you know, we see these demonstrations against Kavanaugh and so forth. The liberals on the left will get into the streets more now, I think, and that's the good pretext for the right to do it. Mm-hmm. And when you have social movements fighting in the streets, well, that's another indicator of a drift towards a fascist-like society.
Right. And your argument's been that so far the Democrats for the last 2 years have only promised more Democrats. So if you go out and vote, we'll have more Democrats. But they haven't actually been able to articulate a vision. But that was your argument. But as I was reading this stuff you've been writing, I was thinking, well, what about the fact that even people like Booker and Obama and, of course, people like Sanders are saying, you know, we need Medicare for all. And you have Ocasio-Cortez, who's running on a Democratic Socialist campaign. That must be encouraging, right? I mean, that is, people are offering real policies, no?
Well, they're beginning to, but the Democrat establishment is fighting it, you see. They don't want to really promote Medicare for all. Why? Well, you know, I recently went to a presentation with Nick Brana. I don't know if you've heard Nick Brana. But Dick was the Sanders liaison to the Democratic Party during the primaries, okay? Then he was very, relative young guy in his 30s. Then he was key with trying to patch up the relationship between Sanders and the Democrats while the Democrats continued to screw Sanders, mm-hmm. including the recent convention. They'll never let Sanders run under the Democratic Party banner. He finally broke with it. He there was a very interesting point he brought up from the inside that he saw. He said, you know, the Democratic National Committee, over 100 of the members of the DNC are corporate lobbyists and CEOs.
Yeah.
They will never allow a FDR-like program. And that's what's necessary for the left, the liberal, left the center, whatever, to successfully attract the voters to that program. And in the lack of that program, you've got the Trump economic nationalism, you know, free trade bullshit, which is not, he's a free trader. He's just a bilateral free trader. Mm-hmm. Lots of promises and lots of lies and exaggerations of what he's achieved. You know, NAFTA is a good example. That program will continue to attract the working class in this country. That's the big problem. You see, the Democrats, in a way, because the corporate elite have captured that party. This is not the Democratic Party after the late 1980s when the DLC, Democratic Leadership Conference, captured that party. And Clinton was their boy, you see. This is a different Democratic Party that doesn't want to go where FDR went. And that's going to continue to mean, in my view, a failed strategy and a failure to really attract people. And if they don't have an FDR economic program, what have they got? Well, they've got identity politics. And that's all they're really pushing, you know. And identity politics, in my view, is the bane of progressive movements in this country, because as long as people are pursuing their individual identity issues, they're not really uniting and they're not really attracting people who, you know, the white working class who's not interested in identity politics. In fact, the Republicans very, very skillfully have turned identity politics into a negative, you see. So it's a failure of strategy that we've seen in the Democratic Party time and time again here for quite some time now. And that's why the party is atrophying. It's lost most of the legislatures and governorships. It's only got real grassroots base on the two coasts. It's a national election party.
Well, are you excited about the Social Democratic move?
I think the Social Democratic move is a move in the right direction, but it's an eclectic thing, the Social Democratic shift here. Mm-hmm. And if some of them are really, like Sanders and others, believe that what you got to do is organize outside the Democratic Party on a Social Democratic program as a way of bringing them into the party, Democratic Party, and reforming it.
Yeah,
I think that outside-inside strategy is bogus.
Okay,
I think it's a failure. It's not going to happen. That's why I have a big criticism of Sanders. I really think this Our Revolution crowd is really a way trying to leverage those who have left the party and the progressives in the progressive caucus in the party as a way of taking over the party.
Yeah,
not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's a way to save the party from itself.
Yes, yes. But I think, and you can see in the convention here recently, the so-called reforms, give on the first vote of any ballot nomination, the superdelegates will not participate, but the second ballot they can.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've been in a lot of union conventions, and you can organize any kind of a vote down on the first ballot And then the other reform is the chair of the Democratic Party has a right to veto now any candidate.
Yeah.
They've become less democratic. You know, their so-called reforms are less democratic.
Yeah.
And that's why Nick Brannon left.
What are the steps forward then for progressives? And what's the sense that you get in the classroom? Because you're working with young people every day, I imagine.
Okay. Well, the first question is what's got to happen? As you may obviously have ascertained from my comments, I'm not big on reforming the Democratic Party.
Right.
I think we need a truly independent new political party, left of the Democrats who are drifting towards the right anyway.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get that? Well, you've got to convince. It's got to be from the bottom up. First of all, you can't have intellectuals declaring a party and then hope someone comes and it doesn't come. You've got to have real people from real movements, and unfortunately, a lot of these movements are identity politics movements, right? But you've got to convince those people that they've got to come together. And you got to take, the local unions, not the national unions, will never break from the Democrats, and convince the most progressive unions, union locals. And you've got to get real people with real organizations and real movements to come to a founding convention and from the bottom up. And there you create the program. And from there, you have a strategy for going out and giving people hope. But you got to criticize and take on the Democratic Party and take some losses maybe in the meantime, because they're losing everywhere anyway.
Right.
But, they're just a parliamentary party. They're sitting on their butts in Congress and in state houses, whereas the Republicans and Trump with the lead are out in the streets agitating and mobilizing people. That's the big difference, you see. And you may have Cory Booker's and a few others, who are trying to do the same, but there are voices in the wilderness in that organization. Anyway, that's my analysis. As far as the students, me to comment on the students?
I do. Yeah, I just want to respond. I mean, one of the things I remember that, people like Adolf Reed started a new labor party in the 1990s, and it looked very much like the model that you're talking about. Unfortunately, it didn't go anywhere, really, right?
It really started. That's an interesting experience. What happened with the Labor Party? It really started the way it should start.
Mm-hmm.
However, after the 2000 election, the leaders of the AFL-CIO squashed it.
Yeah.
They squashed it because they said, Ralph Nader, the third party, was responsible for Bush's election, which is nonsense, right? Mm-hmm. But they said, we're not going to be responsible for that. We're not going to be the next Ralph Nader in 2004. So they squashed the party. They squashed the nascent Labor Party.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be a labor party.
Without labor
play a big role. But it can't be a labor party, because if that's going to be the sole driver, the AFL-CIO heads, who are lockstep with the Democrat elite, Democratic Party elite, will squash it again. Mm-hmm. It can't be.
Mm-hmm. So, the last point was about your students. So where do you see them right now?
Well, it's kind of a mixed bag. Students are so indebted, living on the edge like never before in terms of, their accommodations and even food. Even a place like UC Berkeley, there's like a third of the students are food deprived now.
Mm.
And the rents are so outrageous, and the tuition and fees are so outrageous, and they're borrowing and they're, $1.5 trillion in student debt.
Yeah.
And when people are that overloaded with economic financial crises, it's hard for them to really get that active. I don't see that much activity, and I teach in a private college, of course, St. Mary's, but I also teach summer at UC Berkeley sometimes and at community colleges, so forth. But they're all hunkering down. They want jobs. They're totally focused on trying to make a living.
Right.
And I don't see the student movement as leading anything.
Mm-hmm. Wait, so if it's not going to be labor and it's not going to be students, where are we?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I think it's not quite true. It's not going to be labor. There are progressive locals, mm-hmm. and a lot of agitation in public employees, teachers, and so forth. Mm-hmm. The big manufacturing companies, labor is dead.
Yeah.
But I think, the public sector, the service unions and so forth, transport unions, they could be a core of labor interest. And, you have other sectors, fight for 15, mm-hmm. right? $15 mm-hmm. minimum wage. Those folks are real. Mm-hmm. And you've got women, who are now agitating, as they continue attack on women's rights, mm-hmm. will deepen now. And of course, there's left intellectuals, mainstream intellectuals, who are getting worried now. There's a core.
Yeah.
There's a core there to put something together. But people got to believe that it's real, you see.
Yeah.
That it's real.
That what's real? That the crisis is real, or that there are alternatives?
No, that the solution, that the solutions are there. Is real.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is a real organization,
right,
with real grassroots people, not just intellectuals. I'm very anti-academics and intellectuals who think they're going to top down, mm-hmm. Be the next party. I'll have nothing to do with them.
Right.
But you've got to bring these people together. The leaders have to realize that unless they come together under one umbrella, they're going nowhere, and they're going to get picked off one by one.